Amen.
Thanks, Pastor Kay.
I am going to jump a little bit ahead today to the crucifixion, so to talk about the crucifixion of Jesus, even though today is actually Palm Sunday, when we're meant to celebrate Jesus coming into Jerusalem and they grabbed the palm branches. We're going to jump ahead to the crucifixion and talk about that today so that next Sunday I can talk to you a little bit about the resurrection. So in Leviticus 16, you may have heard of the concept of the scapegoat. So it was called the Day of Atonement, when the scapegoat would have hands laid on it by the priest, by the high priest, which was Aaron at the time, would be sent out into the desert. So the Day of Atonement was introduced by God. He's talking to Moses, who's the leader of the people of Israel in the Old Testament. And he's talking to Aaron, who's Moses' brother. And he was the high priest, so the one in charge of the sacrificial system and the way that they would worship God through sacrifice. And God introduces this Day of Atonement. You can go and read it. It's in Leviticus 16 in that chapter. And the high priest was instructed, or Aaron was instructed, to place his hands upon the chosen goat. And that was a sign of the sins of the people, the rebellion of the people, the wickedness of the people, everything everyone had done wrong, every mistake that had been made, the fact that the Israelites weren't good enough for God, weren't proving themselves to God, weren't obeying the law enough. This Day of Atonement would come down once a year, and all of that iniquity, transgression, would be placed upon this goat, this one goat. The hands would be laid, and then the goat would be taken out into the desert. The goat would be abandoned. The goat would be sent away. The goat would take away all the sins of the people. And there'd be a chosen person that's job was to make sure the goat went into the desert and even to push the goat off a cliff and bring it all to an end. It was often called the goat of departure. Now, we understand the word scapegoat today. It's still used in our language, is still used in our culture, to be somebody who's scapegoated or somebody who's blamed for doing wrong, maybe unjustly, somebody who becomes the victim of injustice. And we actually get our word escape, you know, that's how it's used, scapegoat, escape. It's a way of escaping, blaming, pushing the blame to someone else, deflecting from ourselves so we don't get in trouble, pointing the finger at somebody else. If you've ever been in that situation, which I'm sure all of us have been at different times, we've been the brunt of somebody else's problem. We've been the fall guy, the whipping boy. We've had fingers pointed at us, often unfairly. We understand what this means. Now, it happened this week for Uber, didn't it? They copped a $270 million fine for the taxi industry in Australia. It happens in sports all the time. On Monday morning, the media will tell us who the scapegoat was for your favourite footy team that lost or soccer team that lost on the weekend. It was this player. It was that coaching decision. Maybe it's the entire club is to blame. The president, the board, who knows? There's always someone to blame. The media is very good at pointing fingers. If there's a relationship breakdown, there's always someone who was to blame, right? There's always someone who, if they had just done this, or if they hadn't have said that, or if they had just acted at this moment, everything would have been okay. I want to talk to you today about how you deal with abandonment, how you deal with being scapegoated. And that's by looking to the cross. And we're going to look at Jesus, who was the true and greater scapegoat than the one we read about in Leviticus 16. Leviticus 16 gives us this understanding of the scapegoat, and Jesus fulfilled that illustration when he died on the cross. As it says on the screen here, Jesus was abandoned by God so that you can never, ever be abandoned by God. I encourage you to take out your Bibles this morning. We're going to look at Matthew chapter 27, and we're going to read through quite a bit of scripture to really get our heads around the crucifixion. And I really encourage you this week, especially if you've got children, grandchildren, this is a great chapter to read through this week. I actually read it through with my children yesterday and our little Sabbath day that we do on Saturdays. We read through all of this in order to give them a deeper understanding of what actually happened when Jesus was crucified. So pull out your Bibles, your phones, or you can follow along on the screen with me. Meanwhile, the leading priests and the elders persuaded the crowd to ask for Barabbas to be released and for Jesus to be put to death. So the governor asked again, "Which of these two do you want me to release to you?" The crowd shouted back, "Barabbas!" Pilate responded, "Then what should I do with Jesus, who is called the Messiah?" They shouted back, "Crucify him!" "Why?" Pilate demanded. "What crime has he committed?" But the mob roared even louder, "Crucify him! Crucify him!" Pilate saw that he wasn't getting anywhere and that a riot was developing. So he sent for a bowl of water, washed his hands before the crowd, saying, "I am innocent of this man's blood. The responsibility is yours." And all the people yelled back, "We will take responsibility for his death, we and our children." On Palm Sunday, Jesus is welcomed into Jerusalem as the King, a recognition of his divinity. He's the Messiah. He's here. It's Jesus. He rides in on a donkey. This is only a few days later, later in the week. The mob has turned. Justice has turned. The tables have turned. Things have changed. Jesus is quickly abandoned by justice. He lived a perfect life, never committed a sin. Yet here he stands before the people, the Israelites, his own people, his own blood, the Jews, his own family, his own disciples maybe in the crowd. Well, some of them, most of them had denied him. He stands before the Roman Empire, Pilate, the non-Jews, the Gentiles. And justice disappears. Justice fades away. The mob that was loving him on Palm Sunday is now crying out, "Crucify him." They're now crying out that the murderer, Barabbas, would be released, would be set free, and that in his place, Jesus, the Son of God, was without sin, had spent the last 3 years healing the sick, raising the dead, preaching the good news, that he would take the spot of this murderer and be crucified in the most horrible way, to be tortured at the hands of the Roman Empire. Let's read on in verse 26. So Pilate released Barabbas to them. He ordered Jesus flogged with a lead-tipped whip, then turned him over to the Roman soldiers to be crucified. Some of the governor's soldiers took Jesus into their headquarters and called out the entire regiment. They stripped him and put a scarlet robe on him. They wove thorn branches into a crown and they put it on his head. They placed a reed stick in his right hand as a scepter. Then they knelt before him in mockery and taunted, "Hail, King of the Jews." And they spit on him and then grabbed the stick and struck him on the head with it. When they were finally tired of mocking him, they took off the robe and put on his own clothes again. Yesterday when I read this to the kids, Jed said to me, "So he was naked when they took his clothes off?" I said, "Yes, Jed, he probably was." The whole process of crucifixion, apart from just the excruciating, torturous death, was also a process of the ultimate humiliation, to make the person, the criminal, feel as undignified as possible, to be stripped naked, to be beaten, to have their manhood stripped away, their humanity stripped away, all of their rights for a fair trial, everything to be stripped away. The whipping was 39 lashes that often would kill a man. Lots of men would not live through the whipping. Lead, bone from animals, all kinds of sharp implements would be attached to the whip. And as it wrapped around the victim's back, it would tear off chunks of skin, shreds of skin. They would lose incredible amount of blood. Once the back was ripped to shreds and the bones were almost poking through, the victim would be often flipped over and then cop the final lashes on the underside of the body. The crown of thorns, if you know the story there, it could have been up to 2, 3, 4 inch long thorns pressed into his head. Not like the crowns of thorns that we see in movies where it's gently placed upon Jesus' head, but this was a crown of thorns that would have seeped deep into his skull, causing incredible pain and more bleeding, let alone the mocking. This is another theme I want to pick up on today. Watch as we read through these next verses. Jesus is constantly mocked. He's constantly made fun of. He's constantly the butt of all of the jokes. Not only is he abandoned by his own people, not only is he rejected by the Romans, not only is justice nowhere to be seen, but he's mocked, he's made fun of, he's undignified, he's shamed, he's naked before all the people. Verse 31, then they led him away to be crucified. Along the way, they came across a man named Simon who was from Cyrene, and the soldiers forced him to carry Jesus' cross. And they went out to a place called Golgotha, which means place of the skull. The soldiers gave Jesus wine mixed with bitter gall, but when he tasted it, he refused to drink it. And they had him nailed to the cross. The soldiers gambled for his clothes by throwing dice. They sat around and kept guard as he hung there. A sign was fastened above Jesus' head announcing the charge against him. It read, "This is Jesus, the King of the Jews." Two revolutionaries were crucified with him, one on his right and one on his left. The people passing by shouted abuse, shaking their heads in mockery. "Look at you now," they yelled at him. "You said you were going to destroy the temple and then rebuild it in 3 days. Well then, if you are the Son of God, save yourself. Come down from that cross." The leading priests, the teachers of the religious law, and the elders also mocked Jesus. "He saved others," they scoffed, "but he can't save himself. So he is the King of Israel, is he? Let him come down from this cross right now and we will believe in him. He trusted God, so let God rescue him now if he wants. For he said, 'I am the Son of God.'" Even the revolutionaries who were crucified with him ridiculed him in the same way. You know, it's interesting, as I was reading this verse yesterday to the kids, it just popped out to me there. The way that they're ridiculing him and mocking him, but they're saying, well, if there's ever a time to perform a miracle, it would be now. If you got off the cross right now, as you said you could, you said you're the Son of God, we would believe in you. It's interesting, isn't it? Because we've all been in the situation before where we've prayed and we feel like God hasn't answered our prayers. We've thought, hey, if God just revealed himself right now, my family members would see that Jesus is true. Hey, I'm in this situation. If God just came through me for me right in this moment, I would really believe that he's the Son of God. This is exactly what the Jews were saying. If he really was God, surely this would be the moment that he would perform a miracle and get off this cross and relieve himself of the crucifixion. The torture of crucifixion, as I'm sure you've heard before, is the most painful way that a person could die. It's where we get the word excruciating from crucifixion. The Romans devised it. The hands and feet would be nailed into a wooden cross, the feet first, and the legs would be bent at 90 degrees, and then the hands would be nailed into the cross. Often as the nail went through the foot, it would sever main nerves in the foot, causing excruciating pain. And the person would hang there, often for days on end, until they died. Crucifixion, however, the blood loss from the whipping, the pain of nails thrust through the hand, the days of exhaustion of hanging on the cross, despite all of these things, it was actually suffocation that would cause death to the victim. I'm going to read this straight from a scientific article published on the reality of the cross. "The difficulty surrounding exhalation, so breathing out, leads to a slow form of suffocation. Carbon dioxide builds up in the blood, resulting in a high level of carbonic acid in the blood. The body responds instinctively, triggering the desire to breathe. And this is where the difficulty comes in. Because of the way they were nailed to the cross, the victim would have to push up on the nails and take a breath before dropping back down again and hanging by their hands. As you could imagine, after a whipping, after the torture, after the dehydration, it becomes very, very difficult. So the body responds instinctively, triggering this desire to breathe, to push up and down with great difficulty. At the same time, the heart beats faster to circulate available oxygen. The decreased oxygen due to the difficulty in exhaling causes damage to the tissues, and the capillaries begin leaking watery fluid from the blood into the tissues of the body. This results in a buildup of fluid around the heart and also around the lungs. Eventually, the lungs collapse. The heart fails, along with the dehydration and the inability to get sufficient oxygen. The tissues essentially suffocate the victim. The decreased oxygen also damages the heart itself, which leads to cardiac arrest. In severe cases of cardiac stress, the heart can even burst, a process known as cardiac rupture. It's quite possible that in the end, Jesus died from a burst heart or from a cardiac arrest. And in this state of just trying to stay alive, trying to catch a few breaths, the blood loss, the dehydration, the mocking continues. The Jews mock him. The Romans mock him. People say that this really isn't the Son of God. This is the verse that I really want to get to today. In this point of pain just before he dies, in verse 45, at noon, darkness fell across the whole land until 3 o'clock. So 3 hours of darkness. At about 3 o'clock, Jesus called out with a loud voice, which you could imagine how hard it would be to talk on the cross. This whole series we've been talking about what Jesus said, the red words, the red letters in the Bible, the words of Jesus. This is the only sentence that Jesus says while he's on the cross. Well, in the book of Matthew anyway. There's some other things in the other books, but in the book of Matthew, this is the only sentence that he utters upon the cross. So where else could we go today in this series of Jesus said than this? Eli, Eli, lema sabachthani, which means, my God, why have you abandoned me? Some versions say, my God, why have you forsaken me? This is actually the first verse of Psalm 22, where David writing his psalm in Psalm 22, the famous psalm that prophesies 1,000 years before Jesus is crucified. Psalm 22 outlines a lot of the crucifixion, even to the Roman soldiers rolling the dice for his clothes. Psalm 22 prophesies that 1,000 years in advance. It's the first verse. David cries out, my God, why have you forsaken me? Jesus, using the same words, says, my God, why have you forsaken me? Why have you abandoned me? Jesus, the Son of God, was abandoned by his own father in this moment because the sins of the world, the transgressions of all of humanity, as the scapegoat in Leviticus 16, they were placed on Jesus. And because of God's perfection, God's honor, God's righteousness, he had to abandon his son in that moment as the sins of the world were placed upon Jesus, the scapegoat, the lamb that would die for the sins of humanity. He became the whipping boy, the fallout guy. He took all the blame. He took all the punishment. Therefore, he was abandoned, forsaken, disregarded. He became the victim of injustice. He was mocked. He was punished. But Jesus was abandoned by God so that you will never, ever be abandoned by God. Verse 47, some of the bystanders misunderstood and thought he was calling for the prophet Elijah. One of them ran and filled a sponge with sour wine, holding it up to him on a reed stick so that he could drink. But the rest said, wait, let's see whether Elijah comes to save him. For the Jews, there was a whole thing about Elijah and the end times, so they were thinking there was some connection here. Then Jesus shouted out again and released his spirit. At that moment, the curtain in the sanctuary of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. The earth shook, rocks split apart, the tombs opened, the bodies of many godly men and women who had died were raised from the dead. They left the cemetery after Jesus' resurrection, so a few days later, and went into the holy city of Jerusalem and appeared to many people. The Roman officer and other soldiers at the crucifixion were terrified by the earthquake and all that had happened, and they said, "This man truly was the Son of God." Interesting. The Jews, the crowd, the mob, remember just a few verses before, gathered around Jesus saying, if this is the Son of God, he would take himself off the cross. So often we think that God should do something at a certain moment, a certain time to prove himself. And this Roman soldier, 10 verses later, is seeing Jesus die, saying, this is the Son of God, putting his faith in Jesus, putting his faith in God. He believes in that moment. Jesus releases his spirit, maybe his willingness to die. He seems to be able to give himself away. The curtain is split, which I could spend an hour talking about that, but that goes into a lot of the Old Testament. The Holy of Holies, a place that no person could go into the presence of God, in the Jewish temple being split, being opened up. That's the divine coming into humanity or being open to humanity. There's an earthquake, a natural phenomenon. The rocks split, the earth quakes, the ground opens up. Godly men and women are resurrected from the dead. Again, giving us a little insight to a few days later when Jesus will be resurrected from the dead. What does all of this mean for us? I've got a little handout for you today, and we're going to use this later in communion. It matches this next slide that I've got here. For us today, right now, what does it mean? What does Easter mean? What does the crucifixion mean? Good Friday mean? What does all of this mean? Well, for us, it means that we are abandoned, we are blamed, we are sinners, we are the scapegoat, we're mocked, we're abused, all of these things go on. We desperately try to avoid these things, right? No one wants to be the scapegoat. Put up your hand if you want to be the victim all the time. You want to be blamed all the time. You want to be the outcast from your community. Nobody wants that. No human wants that, right? And we try to avoid this, don't we? We try to avoid being the fall guy, the whipping boy, being wrong, being punished. But guess what? If you've lived long enough, at some point, you will be blamed. You will be rejected by people. You will be outcast, maybe from your family, maybe from your community, maybe from your friendship group. You might try to put in some good boundaries with your family. You might just be trying to put in some boundaries with your friendships just to keep things healthy. But you'll be scapegoated. The fingers will be pointed at you. No one will see the good motives of your heart. No one will see that, you know, yeah, maybe I made a little mistake, but I'm trying to set some healthy boundaries. I'm trying to confront an abuser or a manipulator. I'm trying to leave a friend behind that's unhealthy or toxic, as Gen Z would say. But still, you end up being the wrong one. Still, you end up being misunderstood. Well, let's flip it the other way. Maybe you've been the bully. Maybe you're pretty good at actually scapegoating others. Maybe some of us are quite proficient at deflecting and pointing the finger. In fact, I'd probably say we're all pretty proficient at that. I know if I'm really honest with myself, if I want to, that's always there for me. There's always someone else who's a bit worse than me. There's always someone else who didn't really understand me properly. There's always a government to blame or a God to blame or a faceless person to blame or a culture to blame or some kind of music to blame or some kind of TV show to blame, or there's always something to point the finger at. What about the mocking? No one wants to be ridiculed. Desperately, as human beings, we're all trying to avoid vulnerability, humiliation, the jeering, being made fun of. We don't want to be exposed. No one likes to be exposed. There's always a bully. There's always someone ready to abuse us sexually, financially, with power, position. There's a boss. There's a parent. There's someone who did wrong by you. There's someone who's mocking you. Someone who maybe did wrong by you and mocked you at the same time. There's always someone, seems to be someone in our lives, right, that's inflicting pain on us for no real good reason. And sometimes that can be some of the people we love the most. But let's flip that as well. Maybe you use mocking a bit. I know a lot of people use humor, mocking to deflect from vulnerability, use humor in order to keep their heart closed or in order to make sure people know, you know, step back a bit. It's part of our Aussie culture, isn't it? To pull people down, to point out negatives in each other. It's just a way of saying, just keep your distance. Because we don't like intimacy. We don't like vulnerability. Or what about abandonment? We all suffer from that. We try to build healthy relationships, but then we get rejected. We try our hardest to reach out. Maybe we, a single young person, you know, aiming at a bit of romance, trying to find a wife, maybe trying to re-find your wife, maybe trying to come back to sex after babies and actually rekindle a little bit in your love life. We feel rejected, we feel misunderstood. Our advances are taken the wrong way. We join community groups, we get involved in our kids' school, but it's always a little bit disappointing. Do you find that? And even right here, even in a church, we give our best to God. We serve like beautiful Ruth shared today. We serve God, but even in the church, it's disappointing. It doesn't always work out how we want. We don't find the Christian friends that we hoped for. That leader doesn't really look after us the way that we wish they would. Once you get involved enough in a local church, eventually you'll be disappointed again, even in the house of God. And in the darkness, like Jesus, we sometimes feel like we're there. For him, it was 3 hours. For us, it can feel like 3 hours. It can feel like 3 years. It can feel like 30 years. We feel this darkness of abandonment. And just like King David in Psalm 22, just like Jesus on the cross, we feel excruciating pain and we kind of cry out eventually, my God, why have you abandoned me? We might have people everywhere. We might have lots of followers on social media. We might have a good marriage. But at the end of the day, there's a deep sense in our hearts of, my God, why do I feel so in the dark and so alone? Why do things never work out for me? There's only one solution to all of these problems. And you know where I'm going to go with this. Jesus took your place as the scapegoat. You are blameless before God. Jesus is the final and better atonement. We spoke about atonement, which means sacrifice, which means paying the price. In 2 Corinthians 5:21, it says, "For God made Christ, who never sinned, to be the offering for our sin, so that we could be made right with God through Jesus Christ." The only way to deal, just look at that bit of paper in your hand. The only way to deal with these things or other things, and if you've got a pen with you today, you feel free to just turn the back over. You scribble your own pain on the back. Maybe there's a person's name who's wronged you. You just scribble that on there. You feel free to write on that. Use that. We're going to use that in communion in a moment. But that bit of paper you're holding there has so much power over you, has so much power to keep you as a sinner, has so much power to keep you in darkness, yet for the work of Jesus Christ on the cross. So why did Jesus have to die this brutal death? You know, some critics of Christianity will say, how could a father brutally murder his own son? And then we say, this is Christianity. Come be a Christian. Come to church. Why did it have to happen this way? It doesn't seem very kind. It doesn't seem very nice. I've put it down for you today, dot point by dot point. So if you want to go home and have a look at this, this is kind of ties all of this together really, really well. I'm going to go through it way too fast, so I encourage you to look at it during the week. You see, the first problem is that God's honor has been offended by people's sin. We are to blame. Your sin, my sin. Humanity's sin, all of sin. God's honor has been offended. And God's justice requires that people take the punishment for their sins. And I've said this to you many times before. If God is really God, he must demand justice where there's wrongdoing. How could God really be God and overlook transgressions, overlook sin, overlook rebellion, overlook selfishness? He can't. He couldn't be God if he was just a nice guy. Because to be God, he must be holy. He must be righteous. He must be perfect. He must be without sin. And he must deal with those transgressions. We know that a bad parent is one that doesn't deal with their children's issues, because that's bad parenting not to confront the immaturity in our child and help them grow into a well-rounded adult. So it is with God, who is holy. He cannot just overlook the sins of the world. Humanity's dilemma is this. I'm going to take this straight from Anselm. This is 1,000 years ago in 1093. Anselm was an Italian theologian who wrote a huge treatise outlining much of this theology. And Anselm says, man the sinner, this is humanity's dilemma, man the sinner owes to God on account of sin what he cannot repay. And unless he repays it, he cannot be saved. We're stuck. We are stuck. In order to repair our relationship with God, we have to deal with sin. But we can't deal with sin because we have no right to come before God. This is the problem. No person can satisfy God, but only a person deserves to take sin's punishment. We're in a rock, between a rock and a hard place. Only God can satisfy his own honor and justice, but God is perfect and without sin. He's the only one good enough to satisfy himself, but is the only one with sin who's not deserving of punishment. In Anselm's words again, therefore, it is necessary that one who is God-man should make it. A being who is God and not man, or man and not God, or a mixture of the both, and therefore neither man nor God, would not qualify for this role. Hence Jesus, who is not a mixture, he was not just God and he was not just man, but he was fully God and fully man, is the only God-man who could take the deserved punishment, become the scapegoat in order to reconcile humanity with God. Is anybody happy about that? That's a very deep theology there that would take lots of time to explain. People do a whole university degree to understand this stuff. I try to put it in simple dot points for you, but I really encourage you to look at that, because if you can get your head around those couple of slides, you will understand the crux of why Jesus had to die on the cross and why God could. God doesn't just pardon our sin. He pays for our sin. This is the great exchange. This is the core of the gospel. Here it is on the next slide. People, you and me, we place our sin on Jesus as the scapegoat, and we receive his perfection. This is the transaction that happens on the cross. This is the transaction that we are going to do today with communion. We're going to enact the same thing that happened on the cross. This is what happens during communion. We act it out again. He bled on the cross. We have a communion cup. His body was broken on the cross. We have the bread to signify that. And we're going to act out again this very transaction. This is why communion is so powerful, such a powerful sacrament, to use a religious term. Because we, like the priest Aaron in Leviticus 16, we are able to place all of our sin, all of our impure thoughts, all of our motivations and ugly stuff in our heart that no one even knows about. Our entire life, everything about us that's fragile and weak and performs and tries and hustles and bustles and falls apart and cries in the night, and all the weakness and the fake strength and all the bits and pieces, as well as the really bad stuff. God offers us through Jesus to place all of that on him. But not just that, to take back from him his perfection. His righteousness, his holiness. That's what it means to be a follower of Jesus. So when God looks at you, he doesn't see your sin, because you've placed that on the scapegoat. It's gone. It's abandoned. It's sent out into the desert to die, but you take back his righteousness and holiness. And so God looks at the follower of Jesus and he sees a son, a daughter. He sees perfection. But it doesn't just stop there. Let's flip it around the other way. Jesus places, so leave it on that slide. Jesus places his perfection onto us. That's why he willingly went to the cross, in order to put his righteousness and his perfection onto us, or to offer it to us. I mean, we have to receive it. We can say no to it if we want. We can say no to God. We can say no to Jesus. We can say no to the cross. But he offers that to us and doesn't just stop there. He says, give me your pain. Give me your abuse. Give me all the times you've been abandoned, you've been taken advantage of. Give me, even if you've been the bully, you've been the perpetrator, you've been the wrongdoer, give it to me. Put it upon me. He's not unwilling in this process. He says, I am here dying, bleeding, suffocating, so that I can take it on for you once and for all. I'm willing to be abandoned by my own father so that you will never, ever be without God as a friend. Jesus was abandoned so that you can never be abandoned. You are loved completely. Jesus said that, right? This is our series today. This is the last sentence of the Gospel of Matthew. Chapter 28, verse 20, the absolute last thing in the whole entire gospel. I didn't even know this until I looked at it this week. Isn't this great? The last thing that's said in Matthew's gospel is not Matthew's summary of the gospel. It is the words of Jesus. And it's exactly what we're talking about today. He says, and be sure of this. Everyone say, be sure of this. Be sure of this. I am with you always, even to the end of the age. And when he's saying the end of the age, he means until the second coming, until this age on earth that you and I are living in right now. It's been going for 2,000 years, or 2,024 years, if you like. We might have to stop saying 2,000 years soon, because we're getting a quarter of the way into the next century. It kind of worked from the 90s to the early 2000s. Anyways, 2,024 years been going for. We're in this age. And until Jesus returns at the end of this epoch of time, Jesus has promised us, because remember, this is after he's risen from the dead. He's come back to the disciples, his friends that abandoned him on the cross. Now they're reconnected and he says, I will be with you. And he says to us, I will be with you until the end of the age. You know what this means? You can look at your little bit of paper again. All that stuff on there, none of that has any power over you. You may have been scapegoated. It means nothing if your eyes are on Jesus, because he is with you. You may have been abandoned, forsaken, rejected, got divorced. Your kids might not like you very much. You might have been kicked out of a job at some point that was unfair. We've all been through this thing. I'm not saying these things don't hurt. I'm not saying these things don't matter, but I'm saying they don't need to matter in the sense of affecting your heart and offending your life, because Jesus took it all upon him. And if you're a Christian, that means that you once and for all put that on Jesus and you have become a child of God. And it also gives you the right that any time something arises in your heart, wounding, hurting, right now, all of us are going to be in some form of pain or suffering, whether that's physical, emotional, mental, financial. Even right now, again, you're able to today, right now, put that pain on the head of Jesus. He can be the one to blame. He is the one to blame. He is the one to put all of this upon. And you can come home to God. Jesus was abandoned so that you would always have a home with God. You would always be loved, accepted, welcome. Jesus was neglected so that you can be welcomed into the family of God. Jesus became the outsider so that you never have to be outside again. Your family can leave you. Your friends can hate you. You cannot have a friend in the world. God will be your friend. God will always have a place for you. God will always be at home. You can go out and build good relationships, friendships. You can try and marry a girl. You can try and build some community. And you don't have to do that in fear anymore, with self-protection anymore. You don't have to, you know, put out your little bits of bait that you try to put out to see if that friend will grab on or see maybe if this new person really likes you or not, but you got all this stuff. You don't have to do that anymore. Place all of that fear, vulnerability, worry. It doesn't matter if you're rejected. Jesus was rejected so that rejection never has to have any power over you again. And Jesus was mocked so that the jeering, the jokes, and not just from the outside, but who gets that on the inside? The self-loathing, the idiot, did that again. Oh, I can never get anything right. Your own mocking spirit, your own mocking voice, your own victim on the inside of you. That's not God saying that. There's no one saying it to you. Pull down yourself on the inside. Do you know that when Jesus died on the cross, the reason he had to die is because he absorbed all of the mocking that he took from the Jews, the Romans, everyone laughing at him as he's bleeding on the cross, just trying to get a breath. His heart's about to explode and they're mocking him and jeering him. He's naked there, vulnerable, shamed, undignified. The Son of God, experiencing the excruciating pain and the most mocking that any human being, humiliation as a criminal, dying as a criminal, all of that's going on. And as he's absorbing all of that for himself, he's also absorbing all of your mocking, all of the criticism, all the gossip that's been said behind your back, the time you were made fun of as a kid, the time you were taken advantage of, you were abused, you were ripped off. He's absorbing all that in himself in death and then taking that down to the grave. That's the power of the cross. All of that stuff is taken into Christ and is taken into the grave, buried deep, deep, deep down once and for all.